My name is Christian Ashley, a seminary student and servant of God, and you are listening to the Let Nothing Move You podcast, a proud Anazal Ministries podcast.
Welcome back to the Let Nothing Move You podcast. I'm your host, Christian Ashley, and I'm a little under the weather today. Not the worst thing in the world, but enough to where it affects my ability right now. So some grace extended my way today would be greatly appreciated, but thank you guys for all the support we've gotten over the past couple of episodes. We've got some new listeners that came along from the crossovers we did with Foreign Saints and, you know, Whole Church and all that. So I really do like what you guys have done. I'm going to try not to cough too much into the mic today, but if it happens, it happens. Sorry. So in light of all that, once again, do know that, like I said last time, I will eventually, I don't know exactly when, I should have asked Brandon, that's on me, will be on my seminary life with him and Joe Day, a buddy walk with Jesus, as we discuss the different interpretations of how creation came to be, you know, theistic evolution, 24-hour interpretation, gap theory, all that mess, and, you know, how, if at all, that should play into our apologetics. So there's that. Really fun episode there. I'm looking forward to hearing it again. Sometimes we kind of individually broke each other just to make the others laugh. It was a really fun time. So without any further ado, we're going to head into the book of Genesis. Today, we're going to be in chapters 39 and 34. Excuse me, 39 and 34. 39 and 40. Just a little loopy from the drugs I'm taking. That's fun. So we'll be starting in verses 1 through 10. Now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, had brought him from the Ishmaelites, who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of the Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him, and he made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he had made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in house and field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge, and because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, "Lie with me." But he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her, to lie beside her, or to be with her. I think we need to start off with, I think that many of us, and as a huge complainer, I would definitely throw myself into the mix here. Many of us, were we in Joseph's position, probably might have just given up and succumbed to our fate and said, "Oh, my family's betrayed me. There's nothing of worth anymore. God doesn't love me. I'm stuck in slavery. I just can either end it all or just continue on living in this mediocrity of life or getting the scraps." Joseph, however, against the softer qualities that made his brothers upset about him earlier on, instead rises above the situation and makes the most of it. It's still not ideal or pleasing to have been made a slave. Never hear that from what I say. But Joseph seizes the opportunity to do his job, and then not only that, to do it well, not knowing if he would be doing this for the rest of his life, or if he would ever be reunited with his family. It would be incredibly easy for Joseph to just give in to despair and give up or work poorly so that maybe one day he might even be killed or thrown out for his inaction. But he works for no reward at first. And there's something to say about that work ethic. Now, once again, this is under the confines of a great evil slavery. I am never, when I'm talking about these things, saying, "Yep, if you're a slave, you should just be happy about that fact and just make the best of it." It's like, no. Joseph is making the best of it, despite his situation, out of his love for God. not because he's accepted, like, hey, slavery is a good thing and I'm glad to be part of the system. And that is exactly how he got to that point in the chattel slavery of America, where we said, those of us in the South who, well, not me, because I believe, if I remember correctly, my family actually hired free men, but I'm not an expert in that scenario. So if that gets contradicted along the way, it is what it is. So let's assume we're in that scenario. That idea was, well, we'll just make them happy and say, this is what you're supposed to be doing. So just God even wants you to be a slave here. It's so much better for you to be a slave here in America. And as we get to the Israelites, it's so much better for you to be a slave in Egypt than it is for you to be free, because we're helping you. We want what's best for you. And that doesn't seem to be the relationship that Joseph has with Potiphar. Now, once again, we look upon this with our modern inclinations and go, this is evil. And yes, it is very much indeed evil. But remember where we are in time. Our modern sensibilities don't exist because it is not the time now that it is then. So for a man like Potiphar to engage in a slave trade is something that he was, it's just part of his society. It's part of what he's supposed to be doing. As someone who is rich, you're supposed to have slaves to handle all the stuff you want because you don't want to pay them. I mean, it's a no-brainer why someone would actually do something like that. It doesn't make it right. It never will. But we need to understand where Potiphar is coming from the culture he grew up in and the system he was influenced by. Yet, in parts, he rejects some of that in how he treats Joseph, making him as high as he is in the house, not giving him his freedom, like which would be the compassionate and loving thing to do. But Potiphar doesn't understand that. So instead, it is compassionate and merciful in his eyes to raise Joseph to the stage that he is in his life and to treat him well, which is something that is remarkable. Now, God, on the other hand, seeing Joseph's plight and his work ethic, blesses him and makes it so that Potiphar himself recognizes Joseph's talents and his connection to God to the point where he gives Joseph prestige and privilege no slave would ever expect from their master. God does not seem to directly speak to Joseph that in the same way that he did to Joseph's predecessors, but it is obvious to Joseph that he is favored by God, and even those who know nothing of God can see it as well. God's blessings aren't meant only for his people, but also to the lost who we bless through our outpouring of his love for them. You see, right here, Joseph is able to make things better for Potiphar because God looks upon him in favor. Because God looks upon him in favor, God gives him these wonderful things. God blesses Potiphar's house for Joseph's sake. God blesses the house of you God blesses you in the midst of the houses of the people who don't believe in him as you serve them, because you are there, because you are his. They're not always ideal. Not everyone has had the greatest bosses in the world when it comes to this life. I've had some that I'd much rather not talk about, but when I was doing things correctly, when I was on fire for him, and there were times when I wasn't, I'll be perfectly honest about that. They received a blessing, not because I'm so great, but because God saw my situation and blessed them. That's something I can firmly say looking back at those times. Now, it may look like God isn't being proactive here. Like, why did he make Joseph not a slave? Well, I have this funny little thing called Exodus we're going to get to where there's hundreds of years that pass by, and it looks like God is doing nothing. That's not what he's not doing nothing. He's still watching over him. Now, he's not allowing the things that would be ideal to us to happen. It kind of feels bad to be a slave in this situation. It really feels bad. But God is using this for his own purposes. This is going to be something set into motion that allows the people of Israel to come into Egypt, live and prosper for a bit, suffer under slavery after that, and then become his people once he saves them from this slavery. And he does it on his time. God is allowing Joseph to suffer temporarily so that when God's blessings are poured out later on, Joseph will recognize and realize God's power and sovereignty. Joseph, if you will recall from when we're introduced to him, did not seem to be someone who took his relationship with God seriously. In fact, he kind of expected things to just happen for him. And we can be the exact same way over and over again. We'll be living through the blessings and go, well, I deserve this because I'm God's. versus no, I deserve nothing, and anything God offers me is a beautiful bounty, and I need to love and accept what he has offered me that I do not deserve. And I think it took Joseph ending up in this situation for him to take God's relationship with him seriously. And as far as his relationship with Potiphar is concerned, Joseph, it's a beautiful thing in the midst of tragedy that he is able to be recognized as a foreigner, which you want to talk about some xenophobes? look up Egyptian history. If you were not Egyptian, you were less than, you were worthless. I think we've covered it before, like, you know, Egyptians would do their very best not to die outside of the country of Egypt because they saw other lands as impure. It's a weird, wacky religious system they had in place that everyone, for the most part, believed in. So anyone else who was outside of Egypt, they were scum. They were nothing. But this Hebrew slave of a people group of only, you know, a couple dozen at best, is put in such high esteem by Potiphar because of what he has done and because Potiphar sees God working through him. And Joseph, to his credit, does not take advantage of this new role and works to benefit his master. On the other hand, Potiphar's wife, whose name is not recorded, seeks to disrupt this scenario, having fallen into lust with Joseph, who, unlike his older brothers Reuben and Judah, does not take advantage of the situation for his own sexual gratification, and instead does his best to be diplomatic and stop anything untoward from happening. Joseph does the right thing by spurning her unwanted advances, but just because he does the right thing, it doesn't guarantee his safety. And I think it is very important that the narrative brings up how handsome he is, because this only happens at least two other times. One I can't remember, but the other is David. And you look at them, it's like, oh, if someone is called beautiful in the Bible or handsome in the Bible, as Joseph is called handsome in form and appearance, that kind of means something about the quality of their appearance and the world sees them. So no wonder, looking upon him, does she feel feelings of lust, but Potiphar's wife doesn't resist him and instead gives in to them. Joseph, doing the right thing, is still going to be punished, as we'll see, but he did everything he could have to make that not happen. And we'll see more of that as we go into verses 11 through 23. But one day, when he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was there in the house, she called him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me." But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. And as soon as she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled out of the house, she called to the men of her household and said to them, "See, he has brought among us a Hebrew to laugh at us. He came into me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And as soon as he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried out, he left his garment beside me and fled and got out of the house." Then she laid up his garment by her until his master came home. And she told him the same story, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you have brought among us came in to laugh at me. But as soon as I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment beside me and fled out of the house." As soon as his master heard the words that his wife spoke to him, "This is the way your servant treated me," his anger was kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. Now, as we look between the interactions for Joseph and Potiphar's wife, we see he has multiple opportunities to give in to sin and his master's wife's demands, but he rejects it every single time, knowing that nothing good can come from the infidelity. This is a classic case of a power situation being used against one person here. Now, this would happen multiple times over in history. Anyone who's looked into your American history will see how the master-slave relationship with male-female worked all the time. That happened with female-male as well. Them in their position of authority saying, "We own you, we can do anything we want to you," led to sexual relationships that never should have happened, using that unbalanced power dynamic to force those men and women to serve their masters for their own sexual gratification. And that's just America. If you look across history, whenever slavery is in play, regardless of where we're at, regardless if we're in sub-Saharan Africa or Rome or where have you, this dynamic has played out, and it has always been terrible. It has always been one where someone in position of authority abuses that for their own needs. And that's what Potiphar's wife is intent upon doing, because she is controlled by her lust and cannot handle being rejected by him at all. And instead of being grateful for his wiser head in this matter, turns her lust into anger, showing with undeniable proof that she never loved him and was led astray by her own sin. Joseph knows that even if they, quote unquote, get away with it, that's something she can always hold over his head. If he ever displeases her in any way, shape, or form, she can always bring up, well, I can just say whatever I want to my husband, and you're going to be the one who gets punished. He knows that's going to be a thing. He knows about the unhealthy power dynamics here, and he refuses to engage in it, knowing he's caught between a rock and a hard place, and it's probably not going to work in his favor either way. So, and Potiphar's wife comes into this scenario. Her lust, thinking it's acceptable, turns into anger because she doesn't get what she wants. And how easily does that shape us all when there's someone we're interested in and they don't give us what we want from them? We don't get a relationship or what have you. And then suddenly those feelings thought, oh man, I'm just so in love with them, turn into bitterness and anger towards them because they didn't do what you expected out of them. That is evil. That is something I've been guilty of, something I've had to repent of. Because guess what? No one owes you anything when it comes to their feelings, when it comes to their relationship with you. And you need to accept that the same way you don't owe anything to them. But we need to guard ourselves and go, well, I desired this, but I thought my intentions were pure, but then our hearts revealed they were anything but. Joseph is the wiser person in this scenario, is able to figure out this is not going to work out in my favor, so let me do everything I can. Be as diplomatic as possible. He has used everything he can bring up to try and make her realize, no, this is evil, this is wrong, don't do this. But she can't let go that he rejected her. So in order to get revenge on him, she lies and tells the male members of the household and her husband that Joseph had tried to force himself on her, but she was able to get away from him by yelling, which, if you had done any detective work at all in this scenario, wouldn't have been true. If Joseph had really been intent on taking her, there were no men in the household there. No one was around to stop him. He could have had his way with her, and there was nothing she could have done. But they take the supposed victim's side without even thinking about the evidence, which goes into the whole scenario. When that charge is brought up against people, who do you believe? Well, objectively, you don't believe either one of them. You look into the evidence. You see how things go. You don't try to blame the victim. You don't try to blame the person there saying did this. You do your detective work. You bring qualified people in. You have them speak. You have them figure out what's going on here. You have people tested. Now, obviously, they don't have the forensics that we do at this point in time back then. But it should be self-evident whether or not this actually happened. But they don't look at that. Instead, we see that she kind of gets away with it. And we don't really know what Potiphar's wife's marital situation was with her husband. You know, was it a loveless marriage? Was he abusive in some way, shape, or form? Given his what he does here, I would say probably not. You know, or was this just one where he was just distant from her sexually? Regardless, even if those things happen, even if he was abusive, even if he was, you know, just sexually distant from her, did not love her in that way, that doesn't make any of this justified to treat one of her slaves in this manner. Not only this, but Joseph rightfully calls out this act as something that would be wicked in God's eyes, who has far more authority than Potiphar and would be the one wronged more if they engaged in mutual lust. Sure. Yeah, if Joseph had engaged with Potiphar's wife, Potiphar would have been afflicted. He would have been wrong. But who would have been wrong more, Potiphar or God? It would have been God, because God as a holy being can abide in the presence of sin. Joseph as his, it makes it even worse in most regards, because Joseph knows better. There's some arguments to be made about how the culture of afflicted Potiphar's wife to think she could get away with this and it was okay. That doesn't make it right, but it helps us understand the point of mind she might have had. But Joseph knew better for a fact and resisted it, because God would be hurt by what had happened, because God would be wronged by the two of them engaging in this had he chosen to go along with it. Now, Potiphar himself was stuck between an impossible situation here. like whether to believe that his wife had been hurt in this manner, and whether to believe that his most trusted servant would ever do this deed. Joseph has given no indication, as far as we are aware of, that he would ever do something like this. And I'm going to say he never would have. So Potiphar, some commentators say that his anger arises because he thinks Joseph had betrayed him. Others believe that it's because he knows his wife's lying, because he knows her character, he's been with her for so long, but he doesn't want to punish her. So since his wife has made such bold claims and everyone is going to hear about this, he is forced to punish someone. So he chooses Joseph, which makes strategic sense. It doesn't make moral sense, but it makes strategic sense. Well, your high-born wife is saying one thing. A lowly slave you purchased for however many bits of silver has been said to have done the deed. Which one are you going to believe in that society? Well, in that society, you pick the person with the wealth, casting him down instead. Either way, he's stuck and chooses to spare Joseph from death, which would be the typical punishment for what he was being accused of, and instead puts him in prison. For a slave to do this to a master's wife, instant death would have most likely been the case across the ancient world. But Potiphar seems, and I'm not going to argue that I agree with the interpretation he doesn't believe his wife's words, but stuck in the conundrum he's in, the quagmire he's in, he chooses to punish Joseph instead. I mean, who knows how wealthy his wife is, if she's from some high family, and if he accuses her of stuff, then things probably won't work well for Potiphar. I mean, who knows? That's speculation. I can't say that for sure. But either way, he puts Joseph in prison rather than killing him, which is in its own way a sign of mercy, and God works through it all. Yet, even while Joseph is sent to prison, he still prospers thanks to the always present guiding hands of God, who raises him up to as high a position as is possible within the prison. You would think there's probably not a hierarchy there that he can get up on. But no, it gets to the point where the person in charge, the keeper of the prison, pays no attention to anything he did with him because he could trust Joseph. Where others would despair, Joseph instead continues to follow God in his teachings, which will be rewarded on God's timing later on. And kind of a side note here, from Potiphar and the keeper of the prison, we kind of see, for the most part, how a good boss should act. It's not like a primary thing we need to read in here, but it's something I just kind of picked up on. A good boss will just trust you with what you've done once you have proven you have been trusted, and then not micromanage you and look over everything that you do. Both Potiphar and the keeper of the prison realized how effective Joseph was as a worker, and then let him do his thing. They went there every 5 seconds looking over his shoulder, or, you know, just making sure other people were telling him what he was doing. No, they just trusted him. And I'd kind of say that someone who just despises micromanagement anyways. But I see that in here. So we'll move from there to chapter 40, will be verses 1 through 8. Sometime after this, the cupbearer of the king of Egypt and his baker committed an offense against their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with his two officers, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. And he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the prison where Joseph was confined. The captain of the guard appointed Joseph to be with them, and he attended them. They continued for some time in custody. And one night, they both dreamed. The cupbearer and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, each his own dream, and each dream with its own interpretation. When Joseph came to them in the morning, he saw that they were troubled. So he asked Pharaoh's officers, who were with him in custody, in his master's house, "Why are your faces downcast today?" They said to him, "We have had dreams, and there is no one to interpret them." And Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Please tell them to me." And we're not entirely certain what the cupbearer and baker did to offend Pharaoh so, but it was enough to send them to be in prison. It could have been they might have made a joke at his expense, and he put them there. It could have been, hey, one of them might have been involved with an assassination plot. And given how justice is doled out to one of them later on, I kind of lean towards that. I can't prove it, but it seems like one of them got caught up in a conspiracy that he was never a part of, and sentenced at the same time, which is why later on he is freed and the other isn't. But once again, cannot prove that. They were responsible for preparing and drinking Pharaoh's food and wine. So It could have easily been a scenario where maybe someone slipped something in there and they pretended to drink or they pretended to eat. I'm going to argue that be the eating part. And because of this, they were thrown in prison. Now, regardless, while they may have offended Pharaoh by their actions, in truth, they had all gone through all of this so that God could present them to Joseph. Everything in their moment in their lives had led up to this moment, to bring them directly to Joseph so that he could interpret their dreams. And eventually, unfortunately, Joseph is able to escape bondage because of the things that happen here. And that is why God is sending dreams to these nobodies. Well, guess what? Everyone's a nobody. But those of us who've been reading the story, these guys haven't appeared yet. They just kind of show up out of the blue. Yet God decides to send them visions. And furthermore, they once were in such a position of power, you know, obviously they're not in charge of the country or anything, but they have an important part to do in the ecosystem of, you know, Pharaoh's court, that if they had had these dreams, they could have gone to the interpreters of the court and say, hey, what's going on with this? But yet that's been taken from them. Yet they're forced to rely on a former slave who is now in prison, who is a foreigner, and someone that they normally wouldn't be interacting with. Joseph's history with interpreting dreams comes back here as well. Only this time he can use it to enrich the lives of others rather than prop himself up. If you recall, that's precisely what he did with his dreams, talking about how he's going to be better than everyone else. Because, hey, that's going to be true in some respects, but being youthful and stupid and egotistical, he takes it the wrong way. Even better, he has learned to humble himself and attributes the dreams and his power to interpret them to God. The people in Pharaoh's court aren't going to be able to do the same because they believe in their own merit, or they're making stuff up, or they're using magic demonically, or what have you. Joseph knows where his power comes from and attributes it correctly. He has no obligation to answer these men's dreams or even comfort them in their sorrow. Yet he has compassion on them and seeks them out as they are under his charge. Joseph doesn't know these goofballs from Adam. Yet he takes the time to get to know them, comfort them, and minister to them in the midst of their strife. That is a man whose heart is set on God. Because remember where he's at. He's not the highest man in Egypt right now. He's not back at home. He is a fellow prisoner who's been given a couple more privileges than they have, at best. Yet he takes the time to be compassionate to them, to love them, to minister to them in their time of need. That is the man of God that God has been molding this entire time through this adversity. The Joseph of chapter 37 does not do what the Joseph of chapter 40 is doing without the hardships he's faced. And we'll go from there and we'll finish off today with verses 9 through 23. So the chief cupbearer told his dream to Joseph and said to him, "In my dream, there was a vine before me, and on the vine there were three branches. And as it budded, its blossoms shot forth, and the clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and pressed them into Pharaoh's cup and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand." Then Joseph said to him, "This is its interpretation. The three branches are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office, and you shall place Pharaoh's cup in his hand, as formerly when you were his cupbearer. Only remember me when it is well with you, and please do me the kindness to mention me to Pharaoh, and so get me out of this house. For I was indeed stolen out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also I have done nothing that they should put me into the pit." When the chief baker saw that the interpretation was favorable, he said to Joseph, "I also had a dream. There were three cake baskets on my head, and in the uppermost basket there were all sorts of baked food for Pharaoh. But the birds were eating it out of the basket on my head." And Joseph answered and said, "This is its interpretation. The three baskets are 3 days. In 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat the flesh from you. On the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, he made a feast for all his servants and lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. He restored the chief cupbearer to his position, and he placed a cup in Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him." Joseph works on the first dream and accurately predicts the future based on his interpretation of it. The cupbearer will be looked at favorably once more by Pharaoh and be restored to his position. That is a truly wondrous thing. You're at rock bottom here. The only other thing that can be lower is death. But for the cupbearer, this is what he wants. He wants freedom. He wants to get out. And this is a guarantee of that. And he knows for sure that Joseph isn't like playing favorites or anything. They just met. And he's not like, oh, well, you both of you guys are going to get out, because eventually we're going to find out. No, they don't all have the same favorable dream. But Joseph doesn't leave it there in his conversation. Instead, being shrewd, being wise, he mentions to the cupbearer, hey, remember me when you get out of here and let Pharaoh know of the unfairness of his incarceration. If anyone can outplay Potiphar, it is Pharaoh, who has the ultimate authority, who is looked at as a god king amongst the Egyptian people. He can get Joseph out of his situation. That is a very wily plan, and it's a very intelligent plan. We'll find out how that goes later on. It's not Joseph's fault. But for now, hey, you're thinking ahead. He's not thinking, oh, I can get something out of this. He's thinking, oh, no, I can use the situation to where you are helped and I am helped. It's a very smart way of doing things. Now, it should be mentioned, some commentators do kind of mention the fact that Joseph is working alongside the captain of the guard. Now, if you will remember, the captain of the guard, as my voice cracks, sorry, I'm becoming a man finally, is a title that was given to who? Potiphar. So that is why some people kind of say that Potiphar knew his wife was lying and he was working alongside Joseph. I lean towards that, but it is possible that there are multiple captains of the guard. Maybe Potiphar stepped down from that position and did something else. So we can't say for sure. Like, it's left vague. There is no mention directly of Potiphar's name here. There's just speculation we can add. And it seems like, hey, he can trust him. And why would a captain of the guard trust a prisoner? Well, if he has a prior relationship to him, would be what some people would say. And I tend to take that interpretation. You don't have to do that. It could just be some other Joe Schmo along the way. Now, the baker, meanwhile, gets an unfavorable dream outcome, wherein he will be executed in 3 days. Now, Joseph, once again having compassion and mercy on him, doesn't sugarcoat it for the baker, and simply tells him the truth, knowing that there's nothing to be done to stop it. As a thing about prophecies, when interpreted by people of God, they are absolutes. They don't change. There's no, like, twist in the prophecy to where, oh, well, you thought it would be this way, but it's actually this way. There's no way to subvert the prophecy. It is going to happen. The hundreds of prophecies made about Jesus, every single one of them came true. And the ones that haven't yet is because we're not that point in history. Every single one true, because when God says something is going to happen, it's going to happen because he is sovereign over time. He is sovereign over all things. And that includes dreams. That includes how we're able to interpret those things. And a baker, who seems to have been the actual criminal in this case, and whatever conspiracy was involved here, gets what's coming to him. Now, unfortunately, despite owing a lot to Joseph, who had proven himself trustworthy and loving and an immense asset in the midst of strife and turmoil, the cupbearer forgets about him, leaving him to remain in prison even longer. We'll find out in the next chapter. It's 2 whole years that it takes to jog the cupbearer's memory. Now, why is this? Could it be like, maybe he was just so caught up and swept up in being freed, he forgot about what Joseph did for him, or what have you? Or if he was just a shallow person who was just happy he was released and didn't care about Joseph? I argue he kind of forgot and didn't mean to forget, but we'll get to that later on. So with all this in mind, Joseph is in a better position in some ways than where he started, while still at one of the lowest points of his life. It's a weird, I don't really know the word to use here to describe his place. It's any other person would have broken under this scenario, yet he remains steadfast. And it's a beautiful thing. I'm so forward to looking to what else we do here in Genesis. So with all that in mind, thank you for listening today. Please, if you get a chance, leave a 5-star review on your podcasting platform of choice. Just help with the ratings there. If you're interested in my own fiction writing, you can find my works at starframewritersguild.com or on Amazon by searching for the name MC Ashley. If you're all interested in some further solid studies into the Bible and its teachings, then check out the other members of the Anisal Ministries podcasting network. You can contact me at letnothingmoviepodcast@gmail.com. I'd like to extend a special thank you to Joshua Knoll for the editing that he does and for the music he adds to the podcast. And with all that in mind, God bless you all in accordance to his will and not mine. And allow me one more time to remind you, let nothing move you.
Hey guys, are you interested in podcasting but don't know where to go? Well, check out Zencastr.com and go ahead and make an account there and use special promo code LETNOTHINGMOVEYOU, all caps. That way you can get 30% off of your next deal to go ahead and set things up so you can figure out how to edit stuff using Zencastr.com to host your stuff, to get things done there. So check out Zencastr.com, use special promo code LETNOTHINGMOVEYOU. All right, see ya.